You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
This is MLB.com Extras, American League Central Edition. I'm Anthony Kastrovitz, and once again, we'll be joined by all the beat writers from the AL Central to see how things are shaping up in the spring camps in Florida and Arizona, and talking about a division that's going to be very interesting. In 2015, I was over at Tigers camp this week, and just being around that club, you still can't help but get the sense that they're the obvious favorite in this division. But we know what the Royals accomplished last year, and we know that the Indians and the White Sox are certainly knocking on the door. We also know the Twins are improved, and we'll make that division deeper this season. So the Tigers are going to have a run for their money, and we'll check in with all the guys and talk about what's going on. So thanks for tuning in. I'm joined, as usual, by Jason Beck, who was all over things in Tigers camp in beautiful Lakeland, Florida. Beck and I got to spend a little time with each other on St. Patrick's Day watching the Tigers versus the Nats. Not a game that went particularly well for the guys with the old English D. But, Justin Verlander was pitching that day, Beck, and, it was a setback for him, I guess, specifically, but he felt like it was a step forward as far as working on some things and developing his secondary pitches and that sort of thing. Is your overall sense on Verlander pretty positive, the way the ball's come out of his hand this spring? I love that phrase, by the way, the way the ball comes out of his hand. Every manager loves that. I love it, too.
Like it's going to do something else. Like it's going to, come out and just flop to the ground or something.
Exactly, yeah. Which, it could be a competitive edge if it came out of some other part of the body suddenly,
There's so many ways to go with that. I think it's kind of gone as expected. The velocity, while I think the days of him throwing 99 and 100 might be done, at least on as far as expecting him to be able to do that deep in the innings, I think you're seeing a rebound in velocity to some degree. It's a building process right now. But I think what Tigers people will have to be encouraged by, at least on the club side, is that he's working in more of a mix of pitches than he seems to get. He's got to be able to work in everything now. He can't just base everything off the fastball. Not that he didn't throw four pitches before, but he threw four pitches with the fastball as a fulcrum for everything. And now you're seeing that he's willing to start out guys with different pitches. He's willing to go to different pitches with two strikes. He's wanting to basically keep guys on their toes. It's not just about basing everything off of predictability of the fastball. So from that standpoint, I think it's gone as it would have hoped, even if the results aren't necessarily what you would want.
Yeah. Well, we know we can't trust the Polk County radar gun, the Joker Martin Stadium radar gun. And one of his first pitches on Tuesday, we registered at a mean 88. His fastball was in 88, and then not soon thereafter, there was no more radar gun reading in the ballpark, and I wasn't sure if he told them to cut it off or if they cut it off. I think they cut it off, probably for good reason there. But Joe Nathan had an encouraging day that day. I was there, and just speaking about him generally, you don't see too many guys booed off the mound in spring training. We know the history there with Nathan, the struggles last season, and some incidents with the crowd as well. Where do you see him as far as his development here this spring and how he's shaping up for 2015?
Well, I don't know if I can ever remember a Tiger who's riled up the community of Lakeland quite the way that Joe Nathan.
it's a very quiet community generally.
Yeah, and especially the weekday afternoon crowd usually tends, a little bit older, more genteel, and they got their dander up when Nathan came in. Now, and to his credit, he got them cheering for him on his way off after he got three outs. He got ahead of all three guys, and they all worked the count full, and then he managed to get them out. He got Tony Gwynn Jr. out swinging and missing at a two-seamer that he set up with four seamers. It seemed to go back to what he was talking about coming into camp, which was fastball command being as important or more important than fastball velocity. And he seemed to be able to locate on the corners in low. And when he was missing low as opposed to missing over the plate and being hittable like he was in the two outings ago. And if you look at the numbers, and I know it's, you know, you have to take the numbers with a grain of salt, but he's had one horrendous outing, one, maybe two okay outings, and the other ones have been pretty good. I wouldn't say he's had a great outing yet, but he's had enough to make you think that, yeah, that he can put it together and that he's not necessarily doomed. Now, he could have another horrible outing, you know, next time out, and you know, we'll all have reason to panic again, but there's at least signs that he can put together three outs in a key situation. This is before you get the adrenaline up for him with the ninth inning, which is something that he seems to feed off of in his own way.
As far as, and the bullpen's going to remain, Nathan and beyond, the bullpen's going to remain a focal point. But as far as, you know, roster battles on the lineup are concerned, the Tigers, so much of it stems off of Miggy and Victor and how they progress. And by all accounts, you know, that's going very well as far as their timetable for opening day. But it basically sounds like it comes down to carrying two utility guys or five outfielders. And, you know, weighing the benefits of each, in your opinion, where does that situation stand, and where do you think it's headed?
The sense I'm getting is that Brad's not going to carry an extra outfield bat just for the sake of having a bat.
Yeah.
It's going to have to be a bat he thinks he can get some use out of, which means it's going to have to be an impact bat with the ability to do something off the bench. And I think in that aspect, Tyler Collins did some nice things for himself with his home run yesterday. Can he sustain that? I don't know. His numbers were not all that good going into yesterday. So if this sparks something, that could do wonders for him. But Brad seems at least open to this idea of getting as much versatility out of his bench as possible. Today he had Hernan Perez and Andrew Romine catching bullpen sessions, you know, getting the catching gear out, which is something that he hadn't talked about before. But he's talking about, you know, one of them being the emergency catcher now if they're in a bind with Avila and whoever is the backup out of the game, which pretty much means that Victor Martinez's days of catching, yeah, unless something unforeseen happens, are done here, even in an emergency basis.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's quietly an interesting thing to watch because I think it says a lot about what to expect out of Brad Ausmus's managerial style here in year two. He's had a chance to go through a full season and get an idea of how he wants to use his bench over the long term. He had Don Kelly last year. We all thought that Don Kelly was going to be viewed in a different light with a new manager. And I think what we found both last year and so far this spring was that Brad Ausmus had a whole lot more respect and value for Don Kelly than a lot of us expected. And now he's trying to kind of manufacture another Don Kelly for his bench.
Yeah. When I was there speaking with Dave Dombrowski, we talked a bit about Anthony Ghost, who's having a sensational spring. More of a low-profile addition for the Tigers, but could be a good one for him. Now, and Dombrowski said, you know, what we're seeing this spring, we know it's not real. This is spring training, of course, and if this carried into the full season, this kid's an all-star all of a sudden. But certainly seems like, you know, could benefit the Tigers and add that speed dynamic and that defense dynamic. And of course, pairing with Rajay Davis out there in center. But what are your impressions of what you've seen from Ghost this spring? Has he surprised you in any way?
Yeah, that's been impressive, even in this early stage. I don't know if he can keep it up. I mean, I certainly don't expect him to keep up quite anything like this. But it kind of reminds me of Austin Jackson's first spring training here, where, you know, he went in being viewed as a center fielder, but kind of an unknown as a hitter. And then he used spring training to vault himself into a bigger role than some people envisioned and kind of ran with it. Now, that said, Austin Jackson had much more of a track record as a hitter in the minor leagues than Anthony Ghost has. So, you know, Ghost, even with more major league time than Austin Jackson had when he, during his first camp, has got a lot more to prove. But he's at least gotten off to a good start to show that the ingredients are there. And I think as important as the numbers are, I think more important is just the comfort level with the swing and the confidence that, you know, hitting coach Wally Joyner and his assistant Dave Newhand seem to be building in him being able to repeat it.
Yeah. We also had some fun back catching up with Tony the Tiger, Tony Clark, now the director of the Players Association, back at his old roots in Lakeland at Joker Marchant. And it was amazing to me when a grounds crew member comes up to him and they recognize each other instantly. Just from the faces, and we're talking about a guy who you probably met 20 years ago, probably a city employee still working there at Joker Marsh. It's just funny, these baseball connections and how that stays with people.
Yeah, it's one of those reminders just what the relationship is like here between the Tigers and the city of Lakeland. And for those people who haven't been around it much or at all, you know, you kind of have to experience it. It's not, and I think I wrote this, it's not just about this, you know, the buildings and the teams. It's about the people here. I mean, there are people who've been working here every spring for 20, 30 years. They make an annual thing. Some of them live down here year round now. Others spend their winters down here from Michigan, and then they go back up soon after the season starts. But, you know, they all become familiar faces for players, for reporters, for, you know, I think even for management. You know, it's really, I don't want to call it a family atmosphere because I think that kind of gets too sentimental, but the familiarity here is just incredible. And I don't know, granted, I haven't covered another team that extensively in spring training to see if anybody could replicate it, but I can't imagine there are many other teams, if any other teams, that have been in one place long enough where you could replicate this.
Yeah, I used to have it with the Dodgers in Vero Beach, and obviously that's a different situation now, and you're right, Beck, it is a special place, and Tigers, from a competitive or a daily scheduling standpoint, it's kind of difficult because they don't have, you know, very many easy road trips, but and that's the case for a lot of Florida teams, but it is a very special atmosphere, and that's I guess one thing you don't get in Arizona, where that real tie between the team and the city, just as a function of, you know, everybody being in that greater Phoenix area, and the Tigers have that really special bond with the city of Lakeland, and again, that showed with Tony Clark's visit the other day. So I want to thank Jason Beck for joining us, joined once again by Jeffrey Flanagan out there in Surprise, Arizona, covering all things Royals this spring, and been a lot to cover. Jeffrey, I guess the big news from this past week is Luke Kochhaver. You know, as we're recording this, it's March 18th, 1 year to the day from his surgery, and you know, realistically, it takes a good 12 months, if not more, to get, you know, back to your old self from that situation. And it sounds like the Royals are going to go the slow play route with him, you know, from opening day.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, he's not pitching any closer than 3 days apart. And as you know, that's going to be kind of hard. We just got 2.5 weeks left for them to condense that time period and make him a useful part of the 25-man roster on April 6th. So, and he's kind of known that. He told me this maybe a month ago and suspected that this might be the case. It's just they have a system for these Tommy John guys that they follow strictly. And I'm guessing that, you know, probably 12 to 14 months or 12 to 13 months is more realistically after you have the surgery. So, you know, there's a pretty good chance that he's going to start on a rehab assignment in Omaha come early April. And, you know, they're right now saying he's looking so good that it might only be 1 or 2 weeks down there if he has to. But he's perfectly willing to do that. He knows it's a long season. He'd rather trade that off and rush back into it and, you know, try to go back-to-back days or anything like that that might cause a setback. So, you know, they'll miss him the first couple of weeks of the season, but there's certainly plenty of depth in the bullpen.
Yeah, we say it all the time. Opening day, it's great. It's fun. It's ceremonial. You'd love to have your best 25 on opening day, but it's very important to be at your strongest in September, as the Royals showed last year. So we'll see how
that's a very fluid roster, as you know, throughout the year. So the 25 men you open up with is never the 25 men you end up with.
never in your wildest dreams. And then they got a deep bullpen. You know, there was talk earlier this spring about them possibly carrying an 8-man bullpen. If O'Shaver was a part of that and they needed to give him proper rest, but that just shows. I mean, they have the depth to account for his absence for a while here.
Yeah, they really do. I think they still a pretty good chance they still go with an 8-man bullpen, which might buy them a little time with the Rule 5 guy, Gustave. They still got Ryan Madsen, who they really like. You know, they've actually are starting to stockpile left-handers here. They've been very impressed with Brian Flynn, who they got in the Aaron Crow trade with the Marlins, and he's looked very good this spring. Been a starter his whole career in the minors and a little bit in the majors, but he's been very effective in little, you know, one or two or three inning outings here. And Franklin Morales, the guy they picked up in the offseason, pitched for Colorado for many years, and they're converting him back to the bullpen, and he's been very strong this spring, and I can't see any scenario where he does not make the team. He's been that good. And really, he was probably on the team the minute they signed him, the veteran guy. And then, of course, you've always got the Brandon Finnegan decision, which they're keeping their options open on that. You know, they're trying to stretch him out to 45 to 50 pitches in case at the end of camp they want to send him to Omaha and, you know, have him develop as a starter. But then they're backing him back down to 20 or 25 pitches in case they want him to be a short guy up here. So they're keeping their options open.
Well, I'd say the more frustrating situation is the second base with Omar Infante and his elbow situation, his elbow condition. Where do things stand with that? Is he kind of running out of time here to get ready for opening day?
A little bit. I mean, I could sense a tiny bit of frustration with Ned's voice the other day talking about it because, you know, we've got, you know, basically 2 weeks from Thursday they break camp and they've got to find out whether their starting second baseman is going to be good to go. Kind of went through the same drill last year with him. Had the cortisone shot on the elbow area in March, and you know, had to rush him to get to the starting lineup on opening day. And we're probably going to go through the same scenario again. I don't see him. He's feeling better. He's told me he's stretching out to 120 feet on his throws. You know, trying to, you know, snap off 60 or 70 foot throws too, and he's feeling no discomfort. So if all goes well, he's been DHing for the last week or so. But if all goes well, maybe next week at some point he could actually get into a spring game. Ned thinks he needs about 10 to 12 games really to, you know, get comfortable and be good enough for the regular season. So we'll see how that develops. But you know, it's kind of been an ongoing thing with Omar. He's a tough guy. I mean, he has a lot of injuries that he deals with. He got hit in the face last April, as you know, and, you know, fractured his jaw, his cheekbone. And he's had back issues. He's had shoulder issues. And, you know, still he played 135 games last year, which I think was the third highest in his career. So no one's questioning his toughness. It's just they just need to get him on.
So devil's advocate, if they're without Infante for any significant amount of time in April, what's that second base spot look like? Christian Colon step into there?
Absolutely.
You have to look outside.
Yeah, absolutely, Christian Colon. Yeah, there's not even a debate. It'd be Christian Colon.
But even
Colon's
for utility
job.
Role, who steps into the utility role in that scenario, in your opinion?
Well, you've got Ryan Roberts. If Infante would not be able to go, and maybe they carry an extra guy on the bench and go with a four-man bench, it would probably be Ryan Roberts. He's looked the best as a utility guy. They've got Jackson in camp, too, but he's not looked quite as well. So that's one of the reasons they signed Ryan Roberts. He's a veteran guy. He can play short, third, second, if they need be. But I really think if you held a gun to my head, I think Infante's going to be fine for opening day, and Colon will be the utility guy. And I really think they're just going to keep a three-man bench and go with eight guys in the bullpen.
Well, I won't hold a gun to your head over.
I reserve the right to change that opinion a week from now. So
okay, yeah, absolutely. All things are fluid. This and really any time of year in baseball, it's always a fluid situation. You mentioned the amount of games played by Infante last year, and Alcides Escobar. He says he's angling for the Royals' consecutive games record, which, as you point out, is not a Cal Ripken type streak, but it is. Still something he's shooting for. And between Escobar and Salvador Perez behind the plate and all the all the games and innings he logs. Does that durability come at any expense for those two guys, in your opinion, especially coming off the late run that the Royals had last year?
Well, it definitely does for Sal. I mean, they have got to adjust their thinking on that, and they're going to. I mean, and that's coming from not just Ned. Ned wants to do it, too. It comes from higher up in the organization, too. They've got to find a way to get Sal rested because come September, I mean, if they don't have a comfortable lead or anything like that, he's going to have to play just about every day like he did last year. That's their best chance of winning. So they've got to get him well rested for that run. They didn't do that last year. And they kind of paid the price because his numbers just tanked miserably down the stretch in September and in the playoffs. So Eske's a different cat, though. A guy's got 0% body fat. You know, I'm really jealous. I hate him. He's just one of those genetic freaks where he just he can do it. I mean, he can play 162 a year and not wear down. I mean, his numbers actually got better in September and October. So he goes ahead and plays winter ball, you know, and he just never stops. He just loves to play. He's one of those guys. And he's never had any long-term injury in his career. And it's not, you know, it's not as demanding a position as catcher, but, you know, shortstops take a physical toll, too. They got guys sliding in and trying to cleat them and everything like that. So it can be demanding, and he's got a lot of diving plays and stuff like that. But I think he's definitely a candidate to go all 162. And Ned even mentioned that as well. He goes, why not? You know, a guy just doesn't – he's mentally ready every day. He doesn't take days off and – he's one of those rare guys who just has the body type that he can handle it.
Well, speaking of guys with probably 0% body fat, Alex Gordon recovered from wrist
another
surgery.
One.
And,
yeah.
Another physical freak and a guy who puts your diet to shame. But how's he progressing? I know he took some live BP the other day, so that's a good sign. And how many at-bats would they like to see from him this spring to know, okay, he's good to go?
They don't need that many. He's going to continue to work out in a minor league camp. He actually played an inter-squad game yesterday and had a home run, a double, and a single, I think in five at-bats. So they'll continue to use him in the minor league camp in games today, but there's some more games that will start tomorrow, and he'll play in the field too, which he's been doing in batting practice anyway. He's been getting his reps out there, and I think he'll be fine. He's reported no discomfort. If he gets into a major league game, a Cactus League game, by the end of next week, he'll have a full week of games. He'll be fine by opening day. I don't think that's a concern to them. He's gotten plenty of reps hitting, and his wrist has responded. Interestingly, too, his biggest concern was whether or not his wrist could withstand a hard check. And it has so far, so he's been very encouraged by that. It's not necessarily just making contact. It's the swings you don't make contact that can kind of mess up a wrist injury like that. And sort of no discomfort. So we'll probably spend the rest of this week in the minor league camp, and then they'll start exploring the idea of getting him some Cactus League games in.
You sense, obviously there's guys like Gordon and Infante who are, you know, significantly trying to get ready for opening day, but now that we're at the midway point of the exhibition schedule, are you sensing that antsiness in the clubhouse, especially among position players in general, as we get into kind of these dog days of spring training?
Yeah, as you know, I mean, it's like I think we've all hit our spring wall at this point. You know, Ned mentioned that the other day. It's like every day is Groundhog Day. You know, you get up at 5 a.m. and you sit and bake in the sun for 12 hours, and then he says, I go home and I go back to I lay on the couch for a while, and then I fall asleep. The next thing, bam, it's 5 a.m. again. I got to do the same thing, you know. So it's like you get to that point. At this point, it's March, whatever, 8th, and you're just kind of anxious to get the season going and get some meaningful games. I mean, there haven't been any, you know, major roster decisions to make. There's some stuff in the bullpen they have to clean up. But, not position players. They're all set there. So they're just trying to avoid injury and get ready for the White Sox on April 6th. So it's I think most of the guys are like that too. You go through different stages of spring training. At first, you're happy to be there, and then you can't wait for the games to start. And then after a couple of weeks of games, you go, okay, let's go home. Let's go back to Kansas City. Let's play. So I think they're at that stage right now.
Yeah. Well, hang in there, everybody. We're getting really close, and camp is winding down there in Surprise, and Jeffrey Flanagan is all over it for Royals.com. Joining us live from Starbucks, working on an off-day feature, a writer never stops, Jordan Bastion. JB, talking about the rotation a little bit. So, speaking of writing, I'm working on this story, you know, kind of assessing spring injuries and how big of a deal are each of them on their own, and kind of rating them on a scale of 1 to 10. The Gavin Floyd injury for the Indians, we know he's out indefinitely, possibly for the whole season. We know they were counting on him to eat up some innings and to shore up a rotation that leans more towards young and inexperienced. So in your opinion, 1 to 10, basically, so you can help write my column for me, but what number do you assign that one?
I mean, honestly, I mean, that one kind of registers, I'd say maybe a 5.
Okay.
And I say that not because it's not a devastating loss, in terms of for Floyd and his career potentially, and obviously this is a guy they were counting on for innings, but the Indians went into the offseason with their 5 starters intact, a group that led the American League in ERA in the second half, some guys with a lot of high upside that we obviously all know about now, Kluber and Carrasco and Trevor Bauer could be poised for a breakout year here, so. Yeah, I think the addition of Floyd was meant to lengthen out the depth chart because every team knows that they're not going to go through an entire year with 5 starters and 5 starters only. But in that sense, you take them off the depth chart and you still have the group that they had at the end of the year. So in that sense, I don't think it's a devastating blow to the Indians. But it obviously does create a little bit more of a headache in terms of trying to plan for maintaining depth. They have guys like Sean Markham and Bruce Chen in the mix, but each of them have an out clause. You've got Zach McAllister, who's out of minor league options. So, should you try and exhaust him as a starter before you consider putting him in the bullpen to maintain that layer of depth? So I think that's where it's affected the Indians the most, is maintaining that depth. But I don't think it's a devastating injury in terms of what their rotation can do this year.
I think 5 is a strong argument. In my rough draft, I've got it at 4 only because Floyd is going to make $4 million this year, and that's a nice, easy correlation there. But certainly in that range and all good points there. One guy who interests me is Sean Markham. He's had a decent camp trying to come back from thoracic outlet syndrome that's wiped him out the last couple of years. And, maybe he's that guy who ends up being the veteran who eats up some innings, but obviously a big question mark there given his past injury woes. So what have you seen from Markham this spring? How realistic a possibility is he? I know he has an out clause at the end of camp. Where do things stand with him?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing that they've been watching with him is the way he's been bouncing back from outings, strictly because, as you mentioned, he hasn't pitched that much over the last 2 years. So they've sort of throughout the camp here been, they started with more days off in between outings than usual at the beginning. Now they're kind of decreasing that to get him more on a regular 5-day type program. And so far they've been pleased with how he's been able to bounce back. And, I mean, Markham's never a guy that threw hard. His ability to survive in the AL East was very reliant on his changeup and on mixing speeds and just kind of being that control type pitcher. So, that's a guy that if he's, back to health and he can bounce back and if he's willing to possibly go to AAA because, he said it the other day, he feels like he kind of owes this organization for allowing him to rehab for the last 2 years or year plus. If he's there, that's a good veteran arm to have there, a guy who's been through it back when the AL East was, very tough to go through. Again, he's bouncing back good. It'll be interesting to see if he winds up at AAA. I don't see him as a leading candidate for one of the 2 spots in the rotation, though.
Right, and that's going to be a kind of delicate situation for him at the end of camp. I mean, who knows what interest will be out there elsewhere. We see guys breaking down left and right in Florida and Arizona. We saw last year the Braves scoop up Aaron Harang late in camp, and he worked some magic for them early last season. So that'll be a tough call, but you always like to hear a guy who does feel a bit indebted to an organization that they have stuck with him here for a little bit. So see how that shakes out. But Francisco Lindor, this is a guy, a lot of eyes on him, Indians top prospect and just a flashy player defensively and really a fun kid to get to know. Really, I don't know if you call it cockiness or confidence, but it's somewhere in that range, and really just a lot of fun to watch. So what are your impressions of him from the spring? We know he's you know, not going to seize the opening day starting shortstop job, but it sounds like he's been pretty impressive all around.
Yeah, I mean, he's more and more, as we see this kid step into the lineup, just he looks like he fits. It doesn't, you know, you start to forget that you're watching a prospect that's getting at bats with the big league team. You start to just view him as this guy that just he fits. He fits in the lineup, and he's fit defensively, and he's had what I've thought would be surprising power for the type of hitter that we kind of, you know, have envisioned through his development. So I think the one thing that stands out with him really, and anyone that you talk to who has been around him will typically say the same thing, that he does come across as very confident, but he does it in a way where it doesn't come across as cocky. You know, I think that's a tough act for a young kid to pull off, especially a first rounder. And so you do get that sense of, you know, kind of that mature beyond his years element to him. And it's true. It is there. I mean, you can talk to a kid for a couple minutes and walk away with that impression. So it'll be an interesting one to watch. I mean, I think at some point this year, I think he's up in the big leagues. I don't think there's any getting around that. It'll be interesting to see what the timing of it will be. Is it contingent on what Jose Ramirez is doing or not doing in the big leagues? Is it going to be down the stretch when they're, you know, maybe looking to have a spark when they're potentially in a playoff run? But I think at some point this kid's going to be in the big leagues. And we were talking the other day about AAA last year, because if you look at his AAA numbers, his strikeout rate went up, his on-base percentage went down. It kind of went against the grain of what he had done up to that point in his career. And what he told us was he felt, because he had all of a sudden been developing some power, he had two home runs in all of 2013, and all of a sudden he was hitting for a little more pop last year, that he felt he just got a little carried away with it. So he's cognizant of that, of the fact that he needs to find that balance between, you know, being that put the ball in play, wreak havoc on the bases type performer, but now all of a sudden realizing he can drive the ball with a little more power than he did earlier in his career.
Well, I'm glad he's cognizant of it, and hopefully he doesn't, you know, delve down the Asdrubal Cabrera path of you know, overswinging, going for the power at the expense of the hit tool. He's got a great hit tool. So another young guy who's fun to watch, and he was profiling more towards a utility type of situation, but Zach Walters has the torn oblique, and kind of a bummer there. There was a guy who had some versatility and probably could have fit into this roster given Nick Swisher's timetable at the moment. How frustrated is he with his situation?
Pretty frustrated. You could tell he was pretty dejected the first day that he got hurt. He actually didn't talk to us, and you know, it was understandable. He's still kind of coping with the realization of kind of the magnitude of that injury, and obliques, you know, are always a tricky thing for hitters to come back from. But when we spoke to him the next day, I mean, he sounded like, you know, he sounded confident that he was in a pretty good spot to potentially be on that opening day roster. And I think that also played into, you know, some of that being dejected about the injury, because he did have a good shot. He's a really intriguing guy. He's a guy that they were running around the infield playing all four spots. He can play the corner outfield spots. He switch hits. You know, I've kind of said that in a perfect world scenario, maybe he develops into Terry Francona's Ben Zobrist. You know, this guy who you could put around at a bunch of different positions, keep him in there as a kind of a regular part of the lineup, but where you could slot him in so many different ways and provide some pretty impressive power. So, you know, that's going to be probably a 3-4 week comeback for him. And, you know, I would imagine under the circumstances, probably begin in the minor leagues just to get kind of those at bats and get reps under his belt and kind of go through his personal spring training again, so to speak, before he becomes an option again for the Indians. But when he is an option, yeah, I mean, I think he's one of the most intriguing guys they have in the fold right now.
Shifting gears, Corey Kluber's contract has been a talking point. He re-signs, you know, at a very low rate. Obviously, he's still in his pre-arbitration years, and the Indians are a really good spot with him contractually. Let's be honest, the guy has a breakout year, and he's in a mature age in his peak years, and they've got him under control for the foreseeable future. So we talked about before, there's probably not great incentive on the Indians' part to do anything too drastic with Kluber. Again, especially when you see so many guys breaking down all over baseball. What's your take on all that, JB?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I don't know. I mean, there's like very little to no precedent for his situation.
Right.
And I think that also plays into it as well. I mean, you have situations where guys have broken out this early in terms of service time, but his breakout coincides with the fact that he's going to be 29. I mean, so you have not only that element of he's a pitcher and there's the risk of the long-term contract for any pitcher, but he's also already a late bloomer in terms of age going against his service time. So, yeah, I mean, if I were the Indians, I might just say, hey, you know, let's just go through this year, see what happens. Can he repeat it again? You know, maybe revisit it later. I don't sense the urgency to get it done now, but you could make that argument that you want to try and curb the arbitration salaries from getting out of control if he does continue to be the Cy Young level. And I know his agents are out here right now. I believe they're here this week for a few more days. So there obviously will be some conversations today, being a team off day, I would imagine. They'd be talking today about it. But I'm not overly optimistic that something gets done. Again, as you said, I don't know if something needs to get done from the Indian standpoint. This is a guy they have under their control, and they know they have him at a low rate this year. I kind of laugh when people on Twitter are like, you know, say that they should be paying the Cy Young winner more money right now. It's, well, if you're a businessman, why would you? I mean, they're paying them what they have to pay them, and they're actually paying them more than they have to pay him. So I think that right now it's a good situation for the Indians. And it's hard to know who has the most leverage there. Right now I would lean on the side of Cleveland.
Well, good stuff from Jordan Bastian, and more coming. We mentioned he's cooking up his off-day feature as we record this, and sounds like a good one about T.J. House almost eating himself out of the organization, basically, some years back, but now he's established himself as a legit back-of-the-rotation starter.
Yeah, it's a good story. Callaway kind of got in his ear after the 2011 season in Kingston. A year later, House shows up, 3 pounds lighter, kind of rededicated himself, and, you know, the Indians were basically about to release this kid from minor league camp in 2012 spring training, and he performed and pitched his way back into the mix. And now Callaway's his pitching coach in the big league, so it's a pretty good story for those two.
And they still have that deep young rotation with or without Gavin Floyd. So, okay, JB says a 5, I say a 4. We'll split the difference. We'll call it a 4.5 out of 10 on the freakout factor scale. This is a very, very special edition of the White Sox podcast because we are joined by Scott Merkin as usual, but unusually. Today is his birthday, the day we're recording this. And actually, any day you listen to this is like Scott Merkin's birthday because he brings such a festive nature to every day of the week. Merk, happy birthday. Thanks for tuning in. How old are you today? Can you tell us that?
First, I'd like to say, yeah, most people who know me would say that any day around me is a celebration. Or maybe, right. Or was it any day not around me? One of the two works. It is it's 49. I'm approaching the big one next year, but one more year of 40s, and that's it.
Well, you're still in the Eagles demographic, so that's good. And
I'm in the Eagles demographic, pretty much.
And you're still living life in the fast lane. All right. Let's talk about opening day. Opening day starter possibilities. Obviously, Chris Sale is not in that mix. One
right.
would assume Jeff Samardzija is the guy. He's lined up to be the guy. Is it looking like opening day for the Shark, in your opinion?
Yeah, you know, I mean, either one of the two guys. You could even do 3 guys make sense there in Samardzija, Jose Quintana, and John Danks. And John Danks, bring it up because John Danks, I mean, again, it depends how much you want to micromanage one day start.
Right.
But John Danks is 7-0 with like a 2.4 ERA lifetime against Kansas City. And also, you know, the most senior member of the White Sox currently on the roster. There's no one who has more service time for the White Sox to still there, which shows you how much Rincon has turned over the roster, because I think this is John's 8th year with the team. So, you know, and then you could also do lefty-righty-lefty against a team that doesn't hit lefties very well, or doesn't hit lefties as well as righties. Kansas City hit everyone pretty decently. But, you know, Samardzija makes the most sense. He's done it 2 years for the Cubs. He had that rare opportunity. I think Jaime Navarro is the only other guy to do it, to start 1 year opening day for the Cubs, 1 year for the Sox. Also a dominant pitcher who fits the mode. And then you have Jose Quintana, you know, one of the more underrated starters, if he still fits in the underrated category. Plus a guy who, you know, wasn't drafted by the Sox, but really kind of given the chance by the White Sox. So it would be a good story there. You know, as of right now, it lines up with Samardzija through a simulated game Saturday and then was moved to start in the Cactus League on Tuesday with just 2 days in between. So you would kind of imagine that leads him, with that move, it leads him up to starting April 6th in Kansas City. You kind of think it's going to be him. And, you know, again, it makes sense, but both guys make sense. And the thing about Samardzija is they're not going to go with a fifth guy until April 12th because of an off, you know, the kind of weather off day after opening day. So he would get those two starts in the first week, and that's what they may be leaning towards more, is giving Samardzija that extra start to start with. And then they're hoping, if not by April 12th, I think the 21st is the next time they definitely need not necessarily a fifth starter, but five starters to go. I think they're hoping by, you know, at the latest April 21st, Chris Sale is back. But again, that's fluid too. So I would think as of right now, you'd have to lean that it's going to be Samardzija on opening day.
Good info and good trivia in there as well, making a start for the Cubs and the White Sox is obviously
a how about that? Yeah, I think Navarro had a little better stint with the Cubs than he did with the White Sox.
I believe so. Well, how about Sale? I know he started to do some light throwing off a mound, so as we said, opening day is not a possibility, but you know, by all accounts, probably not too far beyond that. What is what's the latest on Mr. Sale?
Well, you know, Sale's a great guy to deal with the media, good-spirited guy, has a lot of fun with baseball, which is one of the things that's impressive is just, you know, he's one of those guys that can be an intense competitor. Like last year where he was shutting out the Angels into the seventh, gave up five runs on five batters, which you never see with Chris Sale. Mike Trout hit a grand slam, was upset with himself as he left, but after the game he was fine, so he can separate. He's not a big guy who likes to talk when he, you know, during those rare moments when he's down. So he's kind of injured, I'm talking about. So he's kind of updated us once a week. Every Saturday he's talked to us. And this past Saturday, you could notice, because you don't see him a lot because he's getting treatment with Herm Schneider pretty much, you know, the whole time he's at the complex. But you can notice him walking decidedly better. So, I mean, it's a good step forward. But a good point by Chris Sale was made in that he's not putting a timetable down there because he analyzed it perfectly. He obviously has been following the media and following the fans, following the media in that, you know, if he says, I'm coming back on April 12th, that's going to happen, and he doesn't, then all of a sudden it becomes what's wrong with him. And then if he says, you know, he doesn't say April 12th and they bring him back, then people say, well, they're rushing him back. So I think Chris Sale is going to be out there. The best way to put it is when he's 100%, when there's no risk of anything else happening, when there's no risk of re-injuring the foot, and whether that's April 12th, whether that's April 21st, whether that's May 1st, and I'm just throwing out May 1st as an example. You know, it'll be one of those days, but it's not going to be before him because, you know what, he'll still get, even if he misses three starts in April, he'll still get 30 starts during the year, and that's plenty to get out of Chris Sale, you know, if you have sights on the division. And then, you know, maybe even fresher where they hope in the postseason. But, you know, there's no rush, but there's an urgency. I think that's probably the best way for Chris to look at Chris Sale's situation right now.
And if his foot is trending towards flesh-colored as opposed to purple, that's a good sign as well.
Yeah, just his movement, you can see, was better. But again, you know, there's a long step to go before walking better to pitching seven innings and throwing 105 pitches or something like that.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask about Brad Penny. You know, every camp has these, you know, reclamation projects. They're just interesting guys. Trying to fight their way back to a level they were once at, and Penny's an interesting guy in that regard. Where does he fit into all this, and what are the reports on him this spring?
Well, he's done pretty well this spring. You know, he's been impressive. It's an interesting scenario how they're going to view this, because if they really think Chris Sale is going to be back, I mean, let's say April 12th, well, then you really just need kind of a long reliever down there. Mm-hmm. If it's going to be a couple starts, then do you go with a viable fifth starter? Or do you go with a guy like a Scott Carroll? I mean, and Brad Penny certainly could fit this role too, without a doubt. You know, Brad Penny, Scott Carroll, Eric Johnson, who's on the 40-man, and the 40-man is at 40 right now, which is another point to consider. And, you know, the way Micah Johnson's playing, you're going to have to probably make room for him at some point. So which way do you go? Do you go with kind of an amalgamation of a long reliever spot starter? Do you go with a guy who's strictly a starter? So they have to figure that out. You know, Scott Carroll did that role last year where he basically pitched long relief and then, you know, was called upon every now and then as a fifth starter after he was in the rotation for a good part of the season. So it'll be an interesting decision to come up with. And then, you know, there's the Carlos Rodon situation where, you know, he doesn't break camp with the team unless he's staying with the team. He is not going to be – you can completely rule out him as a Chris Sale fill-in. Carlos Rodon will be there if Carlos Rodon is going to be there from that point forward. So – yeah, I think right now you're looking at Penny, Carroll, Eric Johnson, those guys in the mix for kind of that long reliever fifth, you know, that spot start, fifth starter spot.
As far as another prominent battle, interesting battle goes, one of the more interesting position battles in baseball, just because it is a real unsettled spot on a team that, that views itself as a legit contender in that second base, of course. Has Micah Johnson, certainly from the outside, seems to have a really impressive camp. You think he's kind of asserting himself in that role, Merck? Is that the way that situation is trending, in your opinion?
Yeah, you know, I think they're in a good situation there because Micah Johnson has had a great camp. Carlos Sanchez has had a solid camp also. Mm-hmm. But if you put Micah Johnson in there, and even if you're not quite certain if it, you know, what his defense is going to be right out of the gate, well, you have a guy like Gordon Beckham who's going to be, you know, in that super utility role with Bonifacio, who can, you know, help pick up the slack a little bit. And I don't want to diminish Beckham's role by putting it that way, but you know what I mean, that if you feel like, okay, we need a, you know, a guy who we know is an expert defensive player out there, well, let's put Beckham in for the 7th, 8th, and 9th of this particular game or something like that in second, because he's proven he hasn't played a lot of second in spring because they know what he can do. There's no point for Gordon to be out there because, you know, they know he can handle second, so they've used him at third, they've used him at short, they've used him a couple games at second. But, yeah, I think Micah has the edge right now. I don't think Carlos Sanchez is ruled out, but I think Carlos Sanchez is a great guy to have, even if either way, you know, if Carlos Sanchez is deemed to be the starter and Micah Johnson needs a little more time, well, you have a dynamic force at Charlotte that you can turn to. And Carlos Sanchez is a versatile, solid player who's probably ahead of Micah defensively. So, you know, it's a good option. It's options the Sox really haven't had for a while. You know, it's something that, you know, in the last 3 years has really kind of developed. There was a time where they didn't have any, you know, really top-notch middle infield prospects, aside from like a guy like Beckham who they drafted. But think about it, a guy who got sent down in the first round of cuts, Tyler Saladino, who's coming off Tommy John surgery. He's another guy who could be a very versatile player who plays third, short, second, and first. So they have some options. But I think Micah right now, I said this in the beginning, I think Micah has the edge, and he's certainly only done things to increase that edge, I would think. Or increase the, not necessarily the edge, but the positive outlook on what he can do at the major league level during spring training. I'm not even talking stats, just kind of the way he's handled himself, the professional at-bats he's had, and just what he adds to the lineup, I think, you know, kind of pushes him forward to that second base spot.
Well, speaking of people asserting themselves in camp, Merck has been a multimedia force down there with his video interviews. And the latest with Hawk Harrelson, Hawk is wildly optimistic about this White Sox team, as are a lot of people. But I just wanted to know, Merck, where was your sun hat? He had this awesome sun hat on during this interview, and you were hatless.
I just got a haircut over in the Westgate area, and I kind of wanted to show it off. I probably should have had like the company name behind me of who cut the hair, but you know, Hawk is a unique character and has that unique style, so you know, it works with him. If I would have worn that, I think it would have looked, you know, not so
a little too much.
Not as great as it looked on Hawk. Hawk can carry it off a little better than I can. But I'm hoping, you know, along with doing what I hope is good work for our company, I'm hoping this leads to some late night show too. You know, these. Even if we just do it out of a room in Glendale, that works for me. Even on HBO, any network, just put me on there.
I think you're ready, Merck, especially now that you've reached the grand old age.
Hawk is one of a kind, and you know, he said, I did a story on this, he said he believes, and I think it's you appreciate the fact that he just loves baseball in Chicago, although the Sox are his life blood, that he thinks both teams could be, you know, World Series possibilities in 2015.
Stranger things have happened. It would be a lot of fun. And Merck, I hope you have fun on your birthday. You're 49 today, and don't look a day over 48, in my opinion. You're
well,
aging well.
Actually, I have a day over 48. I'm like 2 days over 48 at this point.
I want to thank Scott Merkin for joining us. We are joined once again by Rhett Bollinger down in Fort Myers for Twins camp. And, Rhett, let's just get to the biggest story out of camp, in my opinion. I saw this picture of Ron Gardenhire showing up looking loose and relaxed and smoking stogies. From the picture I saw, he had one in his mouth and another one in a Ziploc bag. Looks like Gardy's enjoying his retirement time right now.
Yeah, definitely. He was at camp yesterday. I didn't get a chance to see him. I was up in Sarasota covering the game against the Orioles, but he was back there watching the minor league deals because his son, Toby, the coach at UW Scout. And so, yeah, it was really nice of him to be there and talk to a lot of the coaches that are there and a lot of, you know, Twins executives, and a lot of the fans came up to him, and he had his own little bag full of cigars, I hear. And today, Paul Molitor was asked about that. Just kind of how the kind of relationship has been in the past, and they talked much recently. And Molitor said that you know, he's still close with Guardy, and Guardy still emails him here and there, texts him, and offers a lot of support and that kind of thing. So, yeah, it's kind of nice to be back. And he did say that, you know, he's open to managing again in the future. So, yeah, we'll kind of see if that works out.
Well, Twins are a class organization, and Guardy's a classy guy. It's great that they're still on great terms. But as far as 2015 is concerned and Molitor is concerned, a decision to be made about how the top of the order will shake out. I know that's been a discussion in recent days. Danny Santana can handle the leadoff spot pretty well. I guess what he's debating is do you want Maurer in the two hole and Dozier behind him, or vice versa? What's your take on how that might shake out, Rhett?
Well, it's really interesting. I mean, as you can tell, Dozier definitely has more power than 20 home runs last year. 2020 guy, Maurer's more of the double hitter, so it might make more sense. You know, even though traditionally you might think that Maurer's the bigger guy, number three kind of driving in type guy, but truthfully, you know, Dozier has more power right now. Might make more sense to have Maurer hit second just because Maurer does get on base so much. You know, he's a guy that in his career has been over, you know, on base above 400. Last year, even in a down year, he still led the team to 361 on base percentage. So he still gets on base plenty. So it might make more sense to put him in that two hole, let him get on base, and then let Dozier maybe drive him in. So it's kind of the big thing right now, kind of seeing how it's going to work out. Santana's going to be the leadoff hitter, it sure looks like. And Mulder did say that Santana's probably more likely to be leadoff, and that doesn't work out, because he probably moved down to number nine in the hole. Probably not the two-hole hitter like Dozier or Maurer would be. But it's kind of an experiment for now. We'll see how it goes, because last year Dozier exclusively batted in front of Maurer. Now, obviously, we'll see if it goes the other way around.
Nobody would do this, but on paper, you can make a good argument for Maurer as the leadoff guy, couldn't you?
Yeah, absolutely. We actually asked Mulder about that yesterday, and he said that he'd heard that argument before. He kind of likes those, you know, leadoff hitters who can kind of get on the base and maybe create some havoc is what he term he used. Maybe get on base, steal bases, and run around. But really, yeah, I mean, truthfully, Maurer gets on base so much, and really all the advanced metrics love his base running, even if he's not exactly, you know, a burner, not a stolen base guy. But he goes first to third, you know, second to home and all that, just as good as anybody, you know, in baseball according to the metrics. So in some ways it would make sense, but it's not really traditional, and it sounded like Maurer was more leaning toward a guy like Santana with his feet at the top of the lineup.
Yeah. Rhett, Miguel Sano and Byron Buxton both sent out this past week as expected. We know they need more seasoning in the minors, and, you know, hopefully, possibly, we'll see them this summer or fall. But I'm just curious, your impressions and the team's impressions, haven't seen those guys in big league camp for a few weeks, and the impression they made.
Yeah, definitely a good impression, especially Sano with the home runs he hit. You know, those home runs were just incredible.
Yeah,
you know, it was amazing. So the power he had, he made a couple of errors in the field, but for the most part, it shows some surprising athleticism for his size. And we know Buxton, you know, really athletic and showed his speed a couple times. He didn't really hit for, I mean, too high of an average, but still the tools are all there. He's healthy. That's the biggest thing for these two guys, you know. As you know, Sano coming off Tommy John and Buxton with all the injuries he had last year, the big key for them was to stay healthy and kind of show what they have for now. And right, they do need more seasoning. Obviously, a lot of fans are clamoring for both of them because they are such highly regarded prospects. But the truth of the matter is they're both still really young, you know, 20 years old, 21 years old. And Buxton played 31 games last year and only played one game in his career above single A, and that was the one he had a concussion in. And Sano, you know, played double A a couple years ago, but that was before the Tommy John surgery. So really, if you look at it, it made way too much sense for them to go to the minors. You know, they weren't ready for the majors quite yet, but we could see them, you know, late summer if everything goes well.
It'd be great. We've heard so much about those guys. It's amazing how much we hear about these prospects before they come up, and you feel like they're household names before day one. And those guys certainly fit that category. Rhett, we're basically at the midway point of the games themselves. Has anything caught you by surprise, or anybody kind of jumped on your radar that maybe you know, you've seen more out of them than you expected coming into camp?
I think the more interesting thing, I guess, you know, the guys really that really have impressed so far, Eduardo Escobar has been great so far. Obviously, it's kind of one of those things where we talked about it before, but that interesting competition where really it's kind of always leaned towards Santana no matter what Escobar did. But he's been so good now, he keeps kind of pushing them. It's been interesting to see him play so well. And Eddie Rosario, as an outfielder, has kind of put himself in that center field mix along with Aaron Hicks and Jordan Schaefer, which is kind of a surprise. Rosario is a former top 100 prospect. With a lot of tools, but last year, you know, suspended 50 games and then came back and didn't really play very well in Double A, but had a great showing in Fall League. He's carried right over into, you know, the spring training, so he's kind of turned some eyes. And he's still here in camp, when I think a lot of people probably would have thought he would have got cut early. like Sano and Buxton, but he's kind of in that mix. And in the bullpen, I think a lot of, you know, a lot of guys are in that mix now. We don't really know how it's going to shake out yet, but even some non-roster guys like Blaine Boyer and Mark Hamburger pitch really well. It turns some eyes, took some head starts. So, yeah, it's one of those things where the bullpen is still kind of a work in progress, but a lot of guys are pitching pretty well out of it, which gives the Twins some options at least. But at this point, it's kind of hard to even figure out how the bullpen's really going to shake out.
When your last name is Hamburger, I mean, a lot of fans are rooting for you, let's be honest. Is that
exactly, yeah.
As you said, he's opened a lot of eyes, and everybody makes the joke that he throws the cheese and all that. But, yeah, how realistic a possibility is that? He's a good story. I mean, not just a great name, but a good story.
Yeah, a good story. A guy from Minnesota who's been through a lot. You know, he's a guy that also had a suspension for marijuana at one point, and the Twins still liked him as a guy that he's only one of three guys in the history of the organization that literally made the team just from an open tryout. They had an open tryout, and
yeah.
He tried out and ended up making, you know, that was the Rangers a few years later after a trade with Eddie Guardado, and Guardado's famous line, they traded me for a hamburger. But, yeah, he's done really well this spring, and Mulder kind of singled him out for the way he's pitched. A little bit of a hiccup against the Orioles, gave up four runs. Otherwise, he's looked pretty sharp. Yeah, there's definitely a chance. I mean, there's a chance obviously he could just go to the minors for now if he's willing to do that, if other guys that have a little more experience make the roster right away. But he's definitely in that mix to definitely be part of the bullpen at some point this season.
And speaking of the bullpen, Glenn Perkins had the mild oblique strain. Is he trending towards being ready for opening day?
He is. He's definitely going to be pitching in a Grapefruit League game this weekend, a minor league game on Thursday. And Mulder actually has some interesting stuff to say about Perkins today, saying that Perkins is going to be – he talked to Perkins about maybe being able to be used in the ninth inning of tied games on the road, which is something a lot of managers don't like to do because they want to have
right.
a closer for that save situation late in the game. But a lot of times what happens is obviously you don't bring your closer in for the ninth and you're using, you know, worst relievers in your closer and all of a sudden they gave up that run and your best pitcher never sees the field, you know. And I think that Mulder's right. kind of wary of that, of saying, okay, if Perkins is our best guy by far, why are we not going to use him in these really, you know, important situations? And Perkins is a big sabermetrics guy and a big, you know, advanced stat guy, so he's totally on board with it, even though it would mean fewer saves for him. But the good news is for him, health-wise, is that his oblique was really mild. He's going to pitch this weekend. He said, and Terry Ryan, everyone said that he has enough time to get ready for the start of the season. I'm definitely curious to see if his role kind of is any different now as a commander.
Yeah, you also wonder if that might extend to seeing Perkins in the eighth, if it makes sense. If the right guys are coming up for the opposition, there's a slim lead to protect it. That's kind of always an interesting balance a manager has to strike. And I know a lot of guys acknowledge that, you know, it might make sense to bring in your best reliever in those situations, but at the same time, it is a long season, and if you get guys warmed up more frequently, that can hurt them in the long run. So always a delicate balance how to use your closer best.
Yeah, but, definitely. That's the thing. I mean, obviously, with Perkins, a hardest thing, too, is they don't really have – the other guys are kind of in that mix. Casey Keene had a good year, but they don't really have any guys with closing experience, though, so it's always tough, too, that balance of – if you bring him in for the eighth, who gets that save in the ninth? Or if you use him, you know, who
right.
gets the save in the tenth? That's going to be the kind of thing that has to work out.
Yeah. Good stuff from Rhett Ballinger down in Twins camp. All right, everybody. Thanks for listening. This has been MLB.com Extras, American League Central Edition.